This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Green.
Nolan Wells stayed behind on Horn Island on the 4th of July without water, transportation, or his phone, which had been left on a boat with his friends. 2 days later, a park ranger discovered his body in the water. The FBI is currently conducting forensics on that phone, investigating separate death threats linked to the case and maintaining that the local sheriff has jurisdiction, despite the island being on federal land. There's lots of questions in this case, not a lot of solid answers yet, but a lot of people who think they have solid answers based on opinions, thoughts, history, all of it. Jennifer Coffendaffer is joining myself and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, to discuss where this case is at right now and where it is headed. Jennifer, welcome. And are you literally coming to us from Germany today? Is that accurate?
I am in Germany, in Passau, Germany, and I'm just so glad to have you back. It was like Robin and I were trying.
Because Robin sucks. Before,
but everything's copacetic.
Well, I'm glad to be back. I'm glad to be back with everybody. I was just like, wow, Germany. Now that's a little trek there. Well, glad to have you on to dive into this case. I've been following your tweets, been following everybody's reporting on this for the last several weeks when I've been gone. One of the big things on this that seems to stand out is the Snapchat. That's a big thing that is being talked about. And I think it's important to contextualize it. The family reports that Nolan's accounts were wiped clean. That has not been confirmed by Snapchat or any authorities. That's coming from the family. I don't have any reason to disbelieve it, but it is a pretty big piece if, in fact, the accounts were wiped, or was there just nothing ever put on the account to begin with on an island that doesn't have cell service? It's a fair question. It suggests a potential cover-up, and a lot of people are putting their chips in that basket. How heavily does the depth of this investigation depend on that accusation alone being true, Jen?
We may have lost her already.
We may have lost her in Germany already. Robin, I'll go to you. What do you think?
How much is the depth of the everything rely on the Snapchat?
That single, I mean, obviously there's public indictment that's going on here, but I'm curious, and obviously there's a lot of things being pulled, a lot of levers being pulled here to investigate right. this, but that is a big one. I mean, if in fact they get the phone back or Snapchat responds back and they say, it looks like this thing was wiped, and it wasn't just there was no activity. I mean, if there's no right. activity, that tells you the phone was on the boat and nobody was using Snapchat. That could be a possible explanation. But if it in fact does show somebody went onto the account and deleted it
right.
or deleted the posts, I mean, what does that say? What does that mean for the investigation?
So,
if it's a big if, I'm saying that.
Yeah, exactly. And we talked about it yesterday, you know, when we were talking about with Eric, you know, what it would take to kind of elevate this investigation to probable cause on things, right? And go to before judges get subpoenas. And that would be one of them, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yeah.
I think what you do as an investigator and what Jen and I did throughout our career is you start with the laws of probability, as I always do in cases like we did yesterday. I look at the research, I look at the number of riptide drownings compared to number of deaths by homicide in areas like this. And so you just start with a general idea. And mm-hmm. then you start drilling down and you take in all the data from the investigation, the forensics, and also from what the family's saying. You know, the family and individuals, not this family in particular, but any family that is really close to an individual, they're going to have their own confirmation biases of what they're looking for, of what they think might have happened. And you look at all that because that gives you something to look at, examine. And in this case, if they say Snapchat should be there, but it's missing, what it does say is like, all right, look here to see if there's a wobble, as I always say.
Yeah.
And if there's a wobble, well, then that might be something to drill deeper on. And if you see a wobble or a deviation from what you're expecting, that's something you can now bring before a judge and do a deeper dive, a deeper research. Now you can start serving subpoenas to see if there's more there. But if you're not seeing one. It's all copacetic. In other words, if the baseline remains consistent, that things weren't deleted here, they're not deleted here. Stories are somewhat consistent, but inconsistencies that are commensurate to the level of potential intoxicants that were being used. You know, so that's what they're assessing in all these things.
Jen, what do you think? If this Snapchat does turn out to truly be have material deleted off of it, if there's things on his phone that were deleted, what does that mean for the investigation?
First of all, this is just, it's BS. I'm going to get this out here since my Wi-Fi is all in and out. I'm going to cut down to nuts and bolts here.
We're getting super spicy, Jen, today.
Super spicy, Jen.
Snapchats come and then they go. That is the whole thing about Snapchats. Yeah. You're all supposed to be able to see them, number one. Number two, I've been on these raft ups. These raft ups are insane. I lived in the Virgin Islands 4 years. You go out, it's melee, it's partying, it's people all over the place. No one has their phone. This is the where people don't care about their phones. Teenagers don't care about their phones. They're very engaged. They leave the phones on the boat because their $1,300 umbilical cord to the world is not going to be risked. And plus, they got a drink in one hand. They're commiserating with the other. They're not going to have it in the water. He's not doing stories also because guess what? He's a football player hoping for a scholarship. The number one thing, and I've had two kids recruited, one being recruited now and one that was recruited, you do not show underage drinking. So period, end of story. The Snapchat is all BS.
Fair points on that, too, on the recruiting angle of it. Very fair points.
And is there a lot? I mean, are we seeing just a lot of assumptions being made by the adults in the room of how they think their child would have been acting at that moment in time? That because on land, he's on his phone all the time. I mean, and so I get it. I get where they're coming from. His pattern of behavior is using Snapchat a lot, but maybe not specifically in this situation. Is that what we're looking at? And then that because it's a deviation from on land, but you also have to consider the setting to which it was at, that is not going on. And they're desperately searching for answers, that because there's nothing there, that's being translated into something nefarious when maybe it's a very simple explanation. My question would be, did anybody else have Snapchat rocking on that beach that day? And if they didn't, well, then he's kind of in line with everybody else. But I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, one of the things, too, is all the, they said all the phones were left on the boat. So actually, that's congruent. In other words, it wasn't just his that was left on the boat, all of them, to Jen's point. So you have a baseline of behavior of the people on that island. And to your point then, too, Tony, it's not just what the family saw behind the scenes when he's on land. But, you know, that's why people put things out there so you can investigate it, so investigators know what to look at. But those are baseline behaviors that look pretty congruent. Jen, sorry.
It's Jen there. Jen frozen.
She froze.
I think she's frozen. She looks like she's there, but she's not. It's like
thinking.
She's a mannequin every now and then. And then when we say the magic words, hocus pocus alamagocus, she comes back alive. There's five of you who remember today's special from the 1970s and 80s and know exactly what I'm talking about. Behind the scenes, Robin, I mean, what do you the FBI is involved in this to some capacity. Is it limited to Nolan's phone, or does the FBI have jurisdiction to examine the devices of everyone involved here, even before or if this is officially classified as a crime, and if and when they obtain those devices? I mean, what would be their primary focus, you think, to be looking for on those devices of other folks, other than just Nolan himself?
So they're going to have access as much as access is allowed by the individual they're interviewing. So here I am, I'm out there, I'm conducting an investigation as an FBI agent. I'm going to be interviewing everyone I possibly can and writing it up. And part of that interview is, hey, do you mind if I have access to your phone? Can I look at your phone? And then I'm going to be looking at the text messages. I'm going to be looking at searches. I'm going to be looking for and establishing a baseline. In other words, I'm not looking for anything in particular. At first, what I'm looking for is, what is a normal day looking like? So here's what I'm going to do is probably me, I'm going to ask them, have you ever been out to this island before? Oh, you have? Can I see your phone from that time period? Because what I want to do is I want to establish, like, all right, if I've talked to a bunch of people that have been out to Horn Island before, I want to see what that past experience was like when something didn't go wrong. And I'm going to establish a baseline of how they communicated, Snapchats they did do or didn't do. I'm going to look at the patterns of behavior in this one time frame. I'm then going to then superimpose it to, all right, now let's bring it up to the present. What was different this time around, whether it's through the interview and then also through digital forensics. And I'm going to ask them permission to see all those types of things because they say they're being compliant and open with it. But I also know they enlisted lawyers that we talked about yesterday. So it's really going to depend on the amount of transparency they feel safe having. But at the very least, that's what I'm doing as an investigator. I'm going to establish a pattern behavior from past times, whether it's from them or others when they visit Horn Island, and then superimpose it over this time and see if there's a wobble in there anywhere that could have involved him.
Jen, if you're investigating this, let me ask you first, what sort of authority does the FBI have at this point to look at friends' phones of any sort of depth? And if they are, when they are, what are you looking for first on the friends' devices?
Well, the FBI has authority if granted by these individuals, because the problem is there is no probable cause to look at these phones right now. There just isn't. I was thinking, how am I going to write this affidavit? I can't write an affidavit showing there's probable cause that these people were involved in nefarious crimes, that they were hiding it, and that the phone could, you know, harbor indicia of the crimes. Mm-hmm. I can't do that. But everyone's cooperating. There is no information that none of these kids and their families are cooperating, despite what Al Sharpton and others are doing, trying to really quash that, in a sense, by starting to finger point. And you asked this earlier, and I know my Wi-Fi went out, but I heard you ask it. And that was, Jen, what's really happening here? And what I see is people ignoring facts and putting in their truths, what they think for a narrative, not that they're supported by a factual basis. But basically, what I want to get is consent searches for each of these phones, and I want to look. And that's what's going to happen.
It's consent searches right now, and okay, but in something like this, I mean, cross the T's, dot the I's, and if there's nothing going on, great. It would be in the interest, if there's nothing going on, of everyone, in theory, you would think, to turn over the devices and say, here, take a look, so the truth can come out. There's nothing found here. But there's tremendous public pressure right now going on. As we know, this has already become such a polarized case where one side is screaming it's this, one side is screaming it's not this. Neither side has facts. Neither side knows truth. Nobody knows exactly what happened yet, but people have their confirmation bias on both ends of this. How dangerous is the confirmation bias right now for folks who may have a device that really there's nothing suspicious on it, but they don't want their name somehow ending up in the ether of this to end up popping up on somebody's social media and then be targeted for having been involved in something nefarious when they're just like, I just want to help. I just want to show you what's on my phone and I got nothing going on. But they're too scared to do that because of the vitriol that's going on right now.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I would argue that there are facts and evidence. We already have witness statements out there.
Okay.
We already know that an autopsy has been performed and that individuals involved in this investigation have at least those preliminary results. If you are the detective or case agent on this case, you are literally sitting there as it's being performed and you are already being told, yes, there was water in the lungs. Thus, we know it's a drowning. We don't see any signs of blunt force trauma. We don't see any petechia. We don't see any signs of strangulation. They have already been told that. That is what happens in the autopsy room. Mm-hmm. So law enforcement, that is why I believe they came out initially and said, listen, this looks like an accident. It does not look like there's anything nefarious. We also don't have any witnesses saying there was some sort of fight, some sort of struggle, anything bad occurred on that boat. In fact, we have the opposite. We have the NBC footage where they're specifically talking about their bilge isn't working and they're getting water on their boat. Yeah. So they want to head back. I mean, there's a lot of facts out here, but people don't like the facts they're seeing.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Especially when I heard that new audio come out about the boat sinking. Again, it's just more confirmation, good data on the initial story that was told, actually a little bit more than I thought it was even going to be. But to your point, people are trying to fill in gaps for a narrative they're trying to keep creating. But so far, again, always living in the world of maybe when you're doing an investigation, because something could pop up to shift it one way or the other. But all the data so far is lining up with a horrendous, tragic incident. Yeah. So far.
I mean, I want to follow it wherever it may go. And I think that's the important thing, and not to go this way or that way, because and these are the facts that we know as of right now. Given that there were hundreds of people on this beach, you have a boat full of friends, a conspiracy doesn't really work very well, or a cover-up doesn't work very well when you have more than one person involved. A bunch of drunk teenagers. That's some conjecture there. I can't prove they were drinking. I don't know if they were drinking. Let's just make the assumption that there was probably drinking involved. So we'll work from that as a baseline. Some were probably not. Who the hell knows? But you have people, lots of them. When you have that many people that would have seen something if they saw something, how confident are you that the truth will surface here? And if there is anything nefarious, that would also surface, being the truth. If it's nefarious, there's people who will talk. They're not just going to be like, oh, okay, everybody, let's make this pact and we're never going to say anything about somebody killing our good friend. This doesn't make any sense. With the fact that there's so many people involved, does it make it so much more, how difficult does it make it for a cover-up to even exist this far in? We're like 2 weeks after this happened at this point.
Well, the more people you have involved, the more people, the more witnesses, the less likely you're going to get a cover-up, because it starts involving so many witnesses, so many individuals to be a part of it. And the bottom line is, what in the world would be the motive? Yeah. These were all friends. They didn't see color. I mean, they saw buddies. Mm-hmm. And they went out on a 4th of July trip. There was nothing, no information has surfaced. Robin talks a lot about leakage. There's zero leakage about some sort of, let's get the black guy on the boat. There's nothing like that. And it's really sad to see the spin that you see on this. Mm-hmm. I would also ask audience watchers, have you ever been in a riptide? Have you ever been?
I came up with the velocity there is big. I came up with the velocity of it yesterday on that, typically in that area, because it's it's about 12 miles offshore. Was it 10, 12 miles offshore? Yeah. The riptides through there are typically a lot faster than in many other places when the tide's going out. It is, what did I say yesterday? 12 feet per minute?
It's high. Yeah, I mean, anyone who's never been in a riptide has no idea what they're talking about, because and I find it interesting, some of the arguments that are being made of, like, he was an athlete. He was like, I don't care if you're Jesus. I don't care if you're Superman. If you get caught in that riptide and you're a human being, you're going with the riptide. There ain't no going back from that. And that's a scary, scary thing. And drownings, and I've said this 1,000 times too, they're not always, oh my God, he's out there drowning. It's more like you're having a drink over here. It's like, anybody seen Nolan? And that's how drownings tend to happen. Nolan's phone. Go ahead, Robin.
Yeah, and that's when they actually really do happen too, because all the stats on it, when you combine the alcohol with the riptide, that is always the one that is a precursor for bad things happening in all the cases.
His phone was only retrieved after his mother checked Life 360. The allegations regarding the Snapchat data come from there. You also have other little pieces here and there of the story that have come out. Are there innocent explanations for the events that have come up here that have somewhat been conflicting? The boys saying he was going to stay with the girl. The girl says he was going with the boys. Are all of these, yes, they may be conflicting to a certain extent, but are they explainable with teenagers, alcohol, and being on a boat?
Yeah, absolutely. And they can both be true at the same time.
Yeah.
You could try to be picking up a girl and the girl says, yeah, I'm not interested. And the guy says, okay, I'm headed off with the boys. Or the guy said, I'm headed off with the boys and then tried to pick up the girl. I mean, it's not that anyone's lying. It's just that they're happening at different times. And again, as you point out, we've got alcohol involved. You know, they're young, they're teenagers. These events are absolute fun. They are party events. And to say, hey, I'm going to catch a ride back with the others because I'm kind of scoping out this girl is so typical in these settings.
Yeah. And I just looked it up. Typical in this area, the riptides can go from 1 to 2 feet per second all the way up to 8 feet per second. That equates to about 5 miles an hour plus, which is faster than almost any human being can swim. So that's how fast those riptides are, because that's what's part of the theory is that what's going on.
They are scary. They are deadly. I was in one several years ago, and it was scary as shit. And it was Little Harper who had was on an inflatable that was able to get over to me. This was in Hawaii, and I was able to grab onto it and get me out. And I was just right there in the water. I was trying to get a sea urchin. Actually, I was diving down. I kept trying to I'll get it. Then I dive back down, and I'm like, I'm not nearly the same place I was 2 minutes ago. And I didn't even realize how it had pulled me out so far. It's a scary, scary thing. We'll, of course, continue to cover this wherever it may go. And the reality is all the answers are not in yet. So we're not going to fill in blanks here or there for this narrative or that narrative. We're going to keep following the facts, and we're going to keep bringing them to you right here. Your 100%. Thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue our conversations. Let's go over to another fine group of folks. 16 children were discovered by in a 12 by 12 foot room in Vinton County, Ohio. Some were nonverbal. At least one was in critical condition. Four adults are currently charged. Notably, the attorney for the defendant, previously linked to one of the defendants was linked to a public indecency charge, and that's how they actually found the man. Or found the family themselves. There's now a gag order on the case. Retired FBI Special Agent Jennifer Coffendaffer is here to help us break all this down, along with Robin Dreek, retired FBI Special Agent. There's a lot of questions in this case about what's going on in the dynamics of this family, all of these children in the course of how many years here? It was not a ton. 16 children over 17, 18 years, something of that nature. The attorney general has described the situation as intra-family while DNA testing is underway and birth certificates named Gary Jr. As the father. The public is also questioning whether Gary Sr. might be involved in some of those children's lives as more than just grandpa. Where do you think this goes? Obviously, it's conjecture at this moment in time. We don't know. But looking at the group, I think it's a fair question to ask, what's going on here and where did all these kids truly come from, Jen?
Yeah, you know, when you look at this, a couple of things that have come out recently that I think are really important, and that is that Gary Sr. has been released on his own recognizance, which is shocking, of course, to everybody, but it's because he had this medical issue, and it would literally break the bank of this county, they said, if they kept him incarcerated and treated him. So for that reason, he's been moved to another county, and he's PR bond. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. Well, when he's done with his medical treatment, he's free to go wherever he wants to go. Meanwhile, Junior has said, or Junior's lawyer, hey, we don't want this in the media. So now we have a gag order in place. And Elizabeth, the wife of Junior, has said, hey, listen, I think I should get out because I want to care for my children. I was thinking, it's a little bit late to be thinking like that. What we do have are two good pictures that show us the squalor they were in. There's another video out. I haven't been able to confirm that it's actually real, but I'll tell you what, those people breaking that evidence tape are starting to be looked into by the sheriff. So it's a very interesting case. I think they are all going down for this at this point, based on the photographic evidence and the state of these children.
Let's talk about the gag order for a second on this case. Obviously, it initiated with Gary Jr.'s attorney. But does it truly just benefit Gary Jr.? Or is this benefiting more of the system of the county, of not being able to answer questions that people are now asking? How did this happen? How did this system allow this to exist? How did you not know of all these children being in this home? Because here's about 20 different paths. So you should, in theory, have had some knowledge that these children existed. Can't talk about it. There's a gag order. How convenient. I'm not a fan of this gag order. Do you think that this gag order is put in place more so to benefit the institutions that have failed more so than the actual defendants themselves, Jen?
Well, I'll tell you what, it does benefit both. Because as you well point out, this is egregious on the side of the government as well, from the standpoint that there were so many red flags at the hospital, so many red flags at the school system. They were 18 months to 18 years. And you're telling me all this time nobody knew that 16 children, well, not 16, let's just say 13, weren't getting educated, weren't getting health care. It's just horrible. And actually, there's just no way these nurses could not suspect something awry when you're on child six. And remember, she purportedly is pregnant again.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And that's what I think, too, is in situations like this, I really question the motive or the intent of the individual not saying that the judge is a bad person or anything, but you know, who's the gag order benefiting in this?
I think saying he's a bad person.
Yeah. You know, because when you think about it, it's like the gag, you know, to Jen's point, when you got a county like this that is so impoverished, low tax returns on anything, and all these public services are completely underfunded, they're undermanned, they're overwhelmed, and you have nurses, because I'm going to go as I always do because my daughter's a labor and delivery nurse, you have nurses reporting these things, but it's going into a black hole because there's no money to fund it. You know, a judge could put a gag order on it to not bring in more attention, to highlight the fact that they can't do anything about it, or they don't want to do anything about it, for nefarious reasons or because they just don't have money to fund it. I don't know what it is, but I don't think the gag order helps necessarily anyone but the county as well.
And I don't know that it's nefarious reasons other than lack of accountability and not wanting to be responsible. I mean, that truly is nefarious. I'm almost going like, well, is there another reason? Are they trafficking the kids or something? I mean, that's even more nefarious. But yes, not being accountable, you're exactly right, is also nefarious. Let's talk about Elizabeth, the mother here. Is Elizabeth a victim or a perpetrator? Married at 15, allegedly giving birth to her first child at 13 or 14. Elizabeth's history is polarizing. Her family, believe it or not, exists, saying that she was indoctrinated and estranged for 15 years. Why do you suddenly give a shit about her now? What happened back then, I guess? While her attorney emphasizes her desire for reunification. Is she a victim here? And should she have any contact with her kids, Jen?
So both. 12, 13, pregnant for the first time, gave birth to stillborns. Pregnant again, marries at 15. A judge decides to marry her off to an 18-year-old pregnant 7 months along. She's a victim. There's no doubt in my mind. But at what point do you change from being a victim to somebody who victimizes?
Yeah.
If you look at those kids, the situation they were in, as described, feces, squalor, insects, my belief, rats. I didn't see the rats, but I think they're going to end up being there. You saw the cats there. We saw the filth, the grime. That is victimizing these children. There's no other way around it. So there's at some point, and I know people want to say, well, that's all she's ever known. No, we all know wrong from right. And when you hear your kids screaming, laying in that filth pit, you know that there's something wrong with that innately. That's my opinion.
At what point do you become the victimizer? Is it the second you have that first child and then you are now responsible for another life and you choose to not make good choices? Or is it after the second kid or third kid or fourth or fifth or sixth or seventh or eighth or ninth or 10th or 11th or 12th? There seems to be a few moments in history here where she could have attempted to make a good choice. But I guess where is the line there on a case like this?
The line is when you have a child that actually could have their health compromised. You are not educating them. You have children that are described as feral, meaning to me, that's when you walk into a room and they run and scream and hide because they have no human contact. You have kids that don't know how to talk because they haven't heard language. That's why you have that happen. You add that all up. And the minute to me, you are not taking care of a child, you are then neglecting a child. And that is illegal.
Yeah. It's a fair point because it's easy to say that this is all she ever knew and all she ever did. And so she's a victim as well. But also, I would say legally, if she's going to try to defend or try to say that she's a victim, she's going to have to show some sort of restraint. Because again, you can have the psychological restraints, but for that period of time, she's going to have to then prove that why she was not allowed to make the choice to put him in school, why she was not allowed to clean the house, why she, you know, so again, to your point, Jen, it's a hard thing to defend that you're nothing but a victim when you actually could make choices. Supposedly, I mean, just from the outside looks, I mean, there's a lot of things you can do, even if you're just cleaning a room. Hard to imagine. I do all this reading from ancient history and things. I can't believe with that squalor in that house, they didn't have plague bump up, believe it or not.
Honest to God, it's like, wow, you can live in that sort of filth and survive. I was kind of amazed by that. Well, I guess that's my other, I do wonder about this. From an investigative standpoint, Jen, how far back should investigators be looking at where these people, because this is not their first place. They've jumped around from place to place over the years here. I am wondering, maybe we should do a little digging in the yards of any place that they've existed, not only from these kids and her and Gary Jr., but, you know, the product of them, of Gary Sr. and his wife. I really wonder what's buried in some of these yards. Is that something that maybe they should start doing a little research on or ground penetrating radar on for?
I personally would. If this were my case and I were the case agent, I would go back. I definitely have three places documented that they've lived at, and that's what I would do. I mean, this is a no-brainer to me. Yeah. Also, I want each of those kids examined, fully examined, the females on their hymen, the males on them, because I just, again, going from experience. And we know of 15 birth certificates that I was able to track. There's one I can't track. Why can't I track that? Where's that one at? So there's still so many questions and so many things we don't know. And because of this gag order, it's going to be a while before we really get the answers.
You know, it'd be interesting too. It'd be, again, no one's talking about because I don't know much what dad to get from, but they've only rented homes. I'd be very interested to talk to the owners. Can you imagine being the homeowner that rented these guys?
That could be burning my rentals down at this point.
Good God.
I mean, the big question, and I'm curious to get your take on it, very open-ended. How did systematic safeguards fail these children for all these years? And I know the answer is probably money and people, why can't we fix any of this, Jen?
Well, it's beyond that. I mean, we need to remember they were sequestered in a 12-by-12 basement. People did not see these children. They moved surreptitiously. And to me, that's the crux of this case. If I'm looking at it from a motive, if I'm looking at it from really, was this just they're poor and impoverished? I can't tell you how many poor, poor people that I've known that are impoverished that I've seen with the FBI, and they are very clean. To say somebody is poor means they're filthy pigs is not accurate. And this is just another excuse. Oh, they were so poor. No. There's assistance for that. Also, what checks are involved here? I am dying to see what government assistance, if any, they claimed. Either way, it looks bad. If they claimed it to pay the rent, I guess that's better than not claiming it, which tells me they wanted them hidden from society for their own purposes.
That's interesting because, you know, if you have all these kids, I mean, because they were getting the government checks. We know that. But was it just for the two of them or did it mark down, hey, we got 16 kids, so you get X amount for each child? That would show that they were on the record. And is this more so showing just how one hand doesn't talk to the other in government and nobody can keep track of anything because nothing is in a sort of coherent system that works together to prevent things like this from happening?
And I'm sorry, I'm going to interject on this one thing too, because what I got here is, because I was curious about just answering that question, and we kind of talked about yesterday as well, is like, how does this evade the system, right? Because that's what really happened here. And my daughter hit on this too, when I asked her, who's the labor and delivery nurse, was even if you report it to the hospital, if they're bouncing hospitals, because that's what I just looked up, how many hospitals in the healthcare system are actually involved here? There's quite a few. And if hospital systems aren't talking to each other, that's how these people are evading. Because my daughter's first response was when I asked her, how could this slip through the system? And she said, well, if they're not born in the hospital, it would. And also if they're bouncing hospitals, it's another thing. And so there's like most earlier children born in the Hulzer Health System facilities in Gallia County, conjoined twins born extremely premature, 24 weeks, who died about an hour later, delivered at Ohio Riverside Methodist Hospital in Columbus. Then you have a set of twins were born at Ohio Health Hospitals in Athens County. In other words, and then trauma centers were involved with a care flight and ICU was involved. So you got a lot of bouncing around that's happening. And that's what my daughter was saying. It's so much easier for people to evade the system when the system's not talking to each other. I mean, we saw this in the government all the time. You know, that's why people say bad things happen during 9/11, everything. When systems don't talk to each other, things fall through cracks because the cracks between hospitals, between institutions, organizations can be really, really wide, especially if there's no funding or relationships between them to bring them together. And I think that's a part of the whole here.
I mean, look at like the educational system and the passing the trash, the bad teachers. There's so many safeguards in place to prevent one school from talking to another about a bad teacher that they fired for one thing to move to the next. We saw it in the Devil's Den case.
I just thought of that.
Where it's why don't we have better systems for these sort of things? It's 2026. And we know this has been a problem for years of interagency communication and agencies not communicating effectively with one another, even if they're the same damn type of system, like a school system. But this is not new news, but we never seem to have anything that gets fixed in systems like this. And we're talking about the lives of children. I mean, Jen, why can't we fix these sort of things?
Well, I can. I have a solution. I don't know what you guys think of this solution, but when it comes to CPS, Child Protective Services, whatever the acronym is for the state we're in, it needs to be federal. This is a very simple solution. You can pay workers more. You have a uniform system. Everybody is talking to everybody. You don't have children literally disappearing and nobody knows because they disappear from New Hampshire and show up in New York. You don't have any of that anymore, at least a lessened amount of that. This needs to be federal, and this is such a no-brainer. Take it off the states and make it federal.
It would seem to make some sense. Then you're also asking the federal government to be competent as well. But again, can we do it right if we really want to? I believe we can. We just have to do it, and the people have to give a shit enough about it and hold the people responsible for doing it right and then follow through. But it's an icky topic, and people don't like focusing on icky topics, which I think may be our biggest problem of all.
It's still a Band-Aid, but I think it's at least a better Band-Aid.
It's
you get – again, things fall apart in every system when it becomes the government. But to Jen's point on it, you start having federal dollars involved in it. There's a uniformity, there's a conformity around the system, and everyone hired is going to be at a certain GS level that's going to be in the system. They're not going to be underpaid. They're going to be paid the same anywhere they go. It's got a lot of merit to it. It's got a lot of merit to it.
Yeah. We could just do something.
I want to point out. Oh, sorry, Tony. I tell you something, too. When I saw this case at the very beginning, I thought, finally, we have a case on the board people are paying attention to that involves children being victimized that they're not going to get off easy. And then what happened? Gary Sider Sr. out on a own recognizance bond. It's mind-boggling. And I know they're looking into his mental capacity now, but those kids have been there for 4 years, and these kids are 18 years old. It just, the whole thing, to give him a pass because he's old and may have had a stroke or something like that.
To give him a pass before there's DNA testing on those kids, I think is could be really, really bad.
Well, they're just like, well, we don't have the money for it, so guess we don't have to play by the rules. We can't afford to play by the rules, so just give him an ankle monitor and send him on his way. That's essentially what they did. And
Why don't they just put up some barbed wire around and put it in the same room his grandkids are living in?
I like that idea. I like that idea. Put a couple, you know, feral animals in there. Cover him in, you know, like let's put him in a shark tank. There's a lot of things. I'll stop. I'll stop. You know, he'd make really good chum, is what I would say. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube 8, we would love for you to weigh in. We'll continue that conversation over there. Let's talk about one more case, this one going to trial here. Lindsay Clancy's murder trial. It is starting. Jury selection beginning. A Massachusetts mother charged with strangling all three of her children while her husband was out picking up dinner that she sent him to get. The prosecution says she checked Apple Maps to time his drive and committed the crimes. Then the defense says she was buried under 9 medications and hearing a voice that told her to take her children with her. Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent, along with us today, and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent. This is a case that has a lot of people divided. I think a lot of people are divided based on life experience, quite honestly, of dealing with folks who've had postpartum, whether them being themselves or someone they care about, and understanding just how volatile and scary and horrible that is, and folks who've dealt with the mental health industry and maybe been prescribed cocktails of drug after drug after drug after a nice 5-minute consultation. Here, take this, see if it works for you. Oh, didn't work, try that. And no, again, another story of systems, medical systems, not communicating about what they are giving the single human being that they're caring for. Lindsay Clancy's lawyer offered to formally admit that she killed all three of the kids if the judge would split the trial into guilt and sanity phases. She's not arguing that she did it. She knows she did it. She's saying that she wasn't in the right mental state. Is anybody in the right mental state after taking that kind of a cocktail of drugs and your body doing what it does in the postpartum psychosis state that many say that she was in? Where do you think this goes, Jen, when this gets to the courtroom?
This is my issue with this, okay?
Yeah.
Women know that there are issues with postpartum, right? We've all seen stories. We all are educated about that by our doctors that, listen, this could happen to you and you could have this child and want to kill the child, because that's what postpartum, you're depressed.
Yeah.
You don't want this child, don't want anything to do with that. And we're educated about that.
Yeah.
So I'll never forget this conversation my husband had with me before our first child. He you know, we had a niece that had it and it was bad, really bad. And he just looked at me, and he's a man of few words, and he said, if you feel like killing our son, can you just let me know? And I'll make sure to kind of get him out of the picture. Of course, I mean, I fell in love. I wrote a poem. The only time I've ever been published was a poem about I never knew love before I had my son. Mm-hmm. But my point is we are talking about from A to Z, and we're only talking about Z. we're talking about after all these prescription drugs, blah, blah, blah. What happened to A? What happened to realizing you have an issue and steps being taken to either get the child out of that situation or otherwise protect the children? You know why nobody ever speaks for the children? Children have no voice. In the case we just discussed prior to this, they have no voice. And that is why it's easy to trample and everything. So in my opinion, this the mother who realized she had a problem, she went to Z and then ended up killing. What happened in between?
She went to A, B, C, D, E, F, and G is where she, I mean, she did. I mean, she tried to get help and the doctors kept giving her new cocktails of medicine. I guess the only thing that, I mean, I guess the argument could be made, well, if she's in this sort of state, remove the kids from the house, have them go somewhere else, yes. Have dad move. I mean, but I mean, that's not necessarily a realistic option for most people. It's not like she sat there and said, this is me, deal with it. She did take so many steps. She is the shining example of someone who raised her hand gazillions of times and was failed by the system, and the medications screwed her up even more, and then this was the result, and then the system turns around and says, well, it's your fault.
I get teary every time I think about this case. This is one of the most, I hate covering cases like this too, and I know a lot of viewers are saying the same thing, because outside of the dad being able to step in, to Jen's point, and just take the kids away for years. I mean, it's like, when's the end state on that? And you don't know because you think everything's good. The only thing that looks like could have happened really is that she and her husband, because she's a nurse, she's a labor and delivery nurse. I mean, she knows this world. She knows the doctors. Put too much faith in the medication she was given and thinking it's going to be okay. And it all fell completely apart. And it, geez, I mean, we talked about this before the show even started. What they're outside of just removing the kids from her life entirely, when would it be safe? And she had no idea, and they had no idea because they thought everything was fine. And she's accountable for it. She's taken accountability for it. But taking of life requires accountability. And she took lives. She says she took lives. But does the punishment fit the crime? And that's the big one here. Is like, what's the punishment going to be for the woman who's paralyzed from the waist down, who could serve the rest of her life in prison if convicted, without reason of insanity? I mean, this is the messiest, most horrendous case, one of them we've covered, just because what the hell's the right answer?
Well, like what could she have done different
other than
removing the kids? I mean, it seems like they went above and beyond compared to most parents.
I agree.
In this sort of a situation. That's where I guess, like, Jen, like, what else do you think that other than that could have been done differently here? And why? And does this deserve a murder charge?
So there's only two instances that I personally know very well. One was my one of my dearest friends, and then my niece, who I mentioned, that had these issues.
Yeah.
And that is what you do. You literally don't allow the mother, because it does end, by the way, everyone.
Yeah.
It doesn't last forever. No. It lasts in a very specific amount of time. And so that's what you do. You rally family. And you don't abandon the person, but you just segregate. And that's what you do. You allow visitations, and that's what you do. And I don't believe for one freaking moment that nobody realized there was something off with all that medicine.
Everybody did know there was something off. She was telling everyone things were off. I mean, by that argument, do you go after the husband for being negligent, for going and getting takeout when he knew his wife had been saying that she was thinking of possibly killing the kids? I mean, number one, I mean, it's just, it's so tragic all around. Nobody obviously wanted this to happen, but I don't know that this is something that deserves murder charges. Because if you're going to charge her with it, you better charge him with being negligent too. I mean, or something, for going and getting takeout. I mean, I don't think you should, but by that line, it's like, well, if we're going to go by the letter of the law, I guess that would be part of it. If she's saying she's going to kill the kids and you decide that Taco Bell is more important, even though she, I don't know. And I'm not blaming him. I'm just saying it just doesn't, this doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense why this is being prosecuted the way it is when she's raising her hand saying, just put me away in a mental institution for the rest of my life. That's all I want. But somehow the state wants to go, no, we should put you in a prison.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And I don't know, you know I can't answer it, not having a legal background on it. I'd be interested to hear what Bob and Eric say. But Jen, do you know? So say, you know, so her defense attorney, could they actually go to the prosecutor and say, listen, we're, you know, work a plea deal. The plea deal being, I'll admit guilt, but I got to be under this condition that it's under reasons of insanity and put me here because this is what I'm willing to do because I was not in my right mind, and I admit it. Is there any way they could do that? I'm like, why aren't they working a plea deal like that?
I just have to believe on this case, and we're going to see it play out, that there's more information we don't have. In other words, I want to see communications. I want to see what was really going on in her mind. I think there's so much out there we haven't seen yet. Mm-hmm. And I think the prosecution is saying this was more in control. She was more in control than things are letting on. And so I think that's what we're going to see, but we'll see.
This is a condition. I mean, there's postpartum depression, there's postpartum psychosis. They are two very different things. One is, you know, it's bad. The other is way bad, like imminent. Yeah. This is not going to end well. And obviously, it did not end well. The judge blocked other mothers from testifying about their own experiences with postpartum psychosis. This is something that is not very well readily understood. And I don't, thank God it's not well readily understood, because it's very rare to be in postpartum psychosis, not postpartum depression. Saying that the medical experts they can cover it. That'll cover it for everybody. A psychiatrist explaining psychosis from a textbook hits a little differently than a mother telling a jury that she heard voices too and what it felt like and how she got out of it and how it went to really paint the picture for the jury. Did that ruling, I mean, just kind of gut the defense by not allowing those mothers from being able to come in and help the jury better understand from a first-person perspective, not a textbook perspective, what this woman was going through?
Well, I think the problem is you have different sets of reality in terms of what is the diagnosis for both, right? Aren't they challenging it? In other words, you have two different, you're going to have two different experts on there saying whether she was in psychosis or not in psychosis. Right. And that's why the judge is saying, listen, we're not going to, you know, have a parade of people that were in psychosis when there's a point of argument whether she was really in psychosis or not. It's a question for the jury. So we're not going to put up there. That's like putting all the well mothers up there too, that were able to overcome their postpartum and not go into psychosis, right? So I see why the judge said, forget about it.
Yeah.
Right. And that's what they're saying was, because again, I've seen everyone's comments on it and everyone's spot on, you know, why even go get DoorDash? Why just not leave? They're claiming, you know, on the psychosis side of it, rapid escalation of the psychosis. Yeah. And I get the defense, well, the prosecution on that too. Those cases, I looked up the stats on it, they're extremely rare. That's why he felt safe in doing it, because it doesn't really happen.
Well,
messy.
And I'll tell you this, from the perspective of a man who had a wife at one time who went through postpartum, the person changes pretty quickly. And having never been with someone who had been through that, having no experience whatsoever, you're going off your own life experiences. You don't think that people have the capacity to change as readily as they do and go and believe things that aren't real as readily as they do. You're still going off of your life experience with this person not being like that. So when things do start changing so rapidly and so readily, and especially if you're seeing signs of, well, maybe this is a good day, maybe things are going good, you think maybe you can run out to go pick up takeout down the road for 10 minutes. Probably, obviously, it's a bad choice. It was a choice I'm sure he will regret for every moment he exists on this mortal coil. But at the end of the day, was it his fault that he didn't have the in-depth knowledge of how this works? No. How impactful will his testimony be to that jury, do you think, Jen?
It's going to be very impactful, but I'm going to say this, Tony, is if my spouse, who already I know is on medication, who's dealing with postpartum issues, blah, 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 if they tell me I am going to kill your, I want to kill my kids,
yeah,
I'm not going for takeout. Not no, now, I'm, not ever.
You like, mean, most people wouldn't. Yeah.
Come on. So I'll go for tacos. Mom, you have a glass of wine. We'll be back later. Hopefully you'll be sound asleep.
And it's easy for us to say that, though,
not being
in that moment. It really is.
It is. I'm not trying to be judgmental. I'm just trying to say it seems like so many people don't think of the three kids because that's what I'm thinking about. I'm not thinking about Taco Tico. I'm not thinking about mom on 17 drugs. I am literally thinking about three dead human kids and how that happened. And some effing body needs to be held accountable. That's where my mind goes.
Yeah.
Mine too.
Or Spangles. I'm not thinking about Spangles either since you're bringing up Taco Tico and other Wichita restaurants.
You know, we're definitely seeing the power of the baseline here. And what I mean by that is, if you look at, as I looked at all the testimony about her, what kind of nurse she was, what kind of mother she was, what kind of wife she was, it is such a powerful narrative on this great human being she was. And so when you have an arc like that, a psychosis is a massive, whether temporary or in the moment, whatever they are, they have such a massive deviation from that established baseline. And she had a very, very solid baseline that we don't believe it could ever happen. Obviously, he didn't and no one did. But again, so when it comes to accountability, I really think these doctors should be at least questioned thoroughly. I don't know about the legal side of accountability, but whoever medicated her was way off.
At least look at this and take it as a lesson to learn of how to do better. I don't know that the doctor's going to be prosecuted, but the system did not work how it should to prevent this level of get on this antipsychotic, get on this drug, get on that, get off this, get on, and take a little bit more of that. And none of the systems talking to each other, it created the cocktail for insanity in itself. Even if she didn't have postpartum, you get on that many drugs in that short of a period of time and off, you're not going to be in a safe mental place. And yes, at the end of the day, there's so many things that could have been done differently and done better. I just don't, this just reads so wrong to me that it's a criminal first degree murder case. I mean, it's just, it doesn't add up. It seems like We need to take this as a lesson to prevent other women from having to go through this sort of a hellscape, and not dig her into the ground even deeper than she already is. I mean, she wants to be in a mental health facility for the rest of her life. Good, let her be, and end it. Why do we need to turn this into a parade?
Yeah, and the thing to think of too, because I lost a. My wife and I both went to high school together. We lost a high school classmate of ours to postpartum. What she did to herself was horrendous. So even if he didn't go or they'd removed the kids from the situation, she still tried to end her own life. And that's why she's also paralyzed from the waist down. This was a massive break that she had on that day.
And the reality is for the husband here too, we don't know yet. I'm interested, Jen, here to hear what we don't know yet in this case. But as far as we know, there wasn't previous attempts on the children's lives. So the husband's not, I mean, he's hearing her say that she feels this way. He's never seen her do that. And we have a very hard time as humans of thinking that the worst could happen to us. That won't happen to me. That's on Dateline. That's on this. That's on that. So I think there's that at play too. You don't think that person that you love, that's been a great mom, that's been a great partner, is capable of doing something like that until it actually happens. And then you're off to the races of what the hell was that? It's just a heartbreaking case all around. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. The links are in the description. We will continue our conversations right there. Jennifer Coffendaffer, Break the Case. Go subscribe wherever you get podcasts, also on YouTube. and follow her on X as well. Robin Dreek, retired FBI special agent. It's Not All About Me, his latest book, available wherever you get books, and on audiobook. Go leave a review on Amazon. That's greatly appreciated. Until next time, for Robin, for Jen, for Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.